Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hi.
Hi, Shireen.
This is Shireen. Yeah. Hi, Anna.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Today is an amazing episode of Ethnically Ambiguous. We have Sophia Chang in the room with us today, and she is the baddest bitch in the room. We talk about her book, her career as the first Asian woman in hip-hop. It's inspiring AF.
Yes, so stay tuned for a very good conversation.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Aunt Anna.
Okay.
We just had a conversation about your name.
This always happens.
This always happens. This is a guest episode of Ethnically Ambiguous.
That's right.
Today we have a very special guest sitting with us in the studio.
She's human. She's here.
She's a human and she's here.
She has a book out.
Yes.
It's on Audible. It's an audio book. Is that what they're called these days?
It is.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The book is called The Baddest Bitch in the Room.
I will say, I think she is the baddest bitch in this room.
Let's be real. You nailed it.
Yeah.
We have Sophia Chang here today.
Yeah.
Hello, Shireen and Anna. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I love being here in LA and it's 75 degrees out in the blue skies and sitting with you ladies.
You're from out of town, so thank you for making the time to sit
Absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
What is it like in New York right now, the temperature?
So New York, about a week and a half ago, was 93.
Oh, whoa.
And the next day it was 57.
That's not right.
No, not at all. Thank you, climate change. And for some reason, you know, just because the drop was so precipitous, it feels brick fucking cold.
Of course.
You know, 55 is not that cold, but 55 after 97, you're like, it's winter!
Getting a hot tub and going straight to an ice bath.
Yeah, like at a Korean spa.
God, that's brutal.
Yes, brutal. Yeah.
Well, we're happy to have you here on the West Coast.
We don't get cold here.
I know.
Even when it rains, it's like, is it still like 80 degrees outside?
Yeah. I was cold when I walked in and the AC was on. So, I mean, I'm a child.
Well, that's what we have. We get like AC cold.
Yeah.
Which apparently is something that you can get like there's like a throat sickness you can get from it. That people in Vegas get it because they're
in the casinos all the time.
Yeah, because they're in the AC and then they go and it's like deathly humid and you're like,
wow.
You can get.
The AC is always really high. You know, they've done stories about this. The New York Times has a story about it a few years ago. Women shiver all summer and men are okay. And women, you know, have their cardigans and their scarves and everything at the office because air conditioning is set to the men's metabolic rate.
Really?
Yeah, which is, I think, 5 to 6 degrees warmer than ours.
I'm fucking hello, furious. Patriarchy.
Yeah, exactly.
It trickles down that deep?
Yes.
God,
yes.
Fuck everyone. That's why I'm always fucking cold.
Me too. I'm always cold. Yeah. I always have to bring like a shrug or a scarf. I mean, I have a wrap in there because
I have a car sweater at all times. Yeah, car sweater, a car scarf.
Yeah,
exactly. All times,
I have my, wrap around like this stole. Is that what it's called?
Stole?
My office stole. So I can it's like a poncho that I wrap around that I keep at my desk because I'm like, I get cold.
Yes, me too.
Okay. I've also even lent it to some men in the office to wear.
This has been thrilling tangent, but let's talk about you because that's why we're here. For those of you that don't know Sophia, you have an incredible history as far as in the music industry as like the first Asian woman to ever kind of infiltrate hip hop, I would say. And I want to talk about how that started for those of the audience members that don't know who you are. So walk us through. Let's start with where do you grow up?
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think I should give you guys the context.
Yeah.
Are your parents immigrants?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we're all first gen here, right?
Mm-hmm.
At first gen of color, no less.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was born and raised in Vancouver. So I was a yellow girl in a white world.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to be white, which I think is also very common for many immigrants of color, particularly of my generation. I was born in 65. And in 12th grade, I heard The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and it completely turned me upside down. And then I moved to New York, and I started hanging out at the hip-hop clubs, and it was a very small scene at the time. In 1987, you guys, it was, you know, we go to a club, and everybody in the whole industry is there, and we're all really excited, and we're all understanding that this is a super vital art form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's this kind of cultural explosion, and it's a privilege to be there. And so I started hanging out at the clubs. I started meeting the DJs, the MCs, the graffiti artists, the B-boys, but also everybody on the industry side. And I got a job doing A&R at Jive Records, which at the time was one of the premier independent hip-hop labels. And then I met Wu-Tang, and then everything changed.
Yeah. Can we rewind a little bit?
Please.
As like, let's think about Sophia as a kid.
Okay.
What was, do you remember your first kind of like realization that music is really important to me?
When I was 3 and I was dancing. I do not remember the song, but I remember so clearly my father, God rest his soul, was a math professor, and he did a year's tenure at UMich. And we lived on campus in campus housing. And I was 3, it's 1968, and I just remember being on the couch, and whatever the music was, it just moved me. Mm-hmm. And I started dancing, and my father looked at me and he said, "Where did you learn how to dance?" And so it was visceral.
Yeah.
You know, if you enjoy dancing, when you hear a beat, it's it just really gets to you. Gets at you.
You can't sit still. You have to move. You have to embrace it.
Exactly.
So, okay, let's go even further back.
Okay.
Your mother is from North Korea and your father is from South Korea.
Yes.
The story you tell in your book, I kind of want like about how your mom came to America, or like the circumstances that brought her here or to
Canada.
Canada, yes, sorry. I'm so American. Look at me. I can't remember any other place in the world.
The West is just the U.S.
Yeah, I don't know anything. L.A., that's all there is. Yeah. But so... can you kind of break down a little what was going on in North Korea and what kind of led her to come to America? Or I did it again, to Canada.
No, absolutely. So, you know, after the war, after the Second World War, Korea was divided into North and South. North was essentially communist, with the Chinese, and the South was democratic and was kind of under the care and the protection of the Americans, which is why you have so many US GIs over there, right?
Right.
And so my mother's family, like many of the families, when they understood what was going to happen and that communist rule was going to come to North Korea, they fled. This is very similar to what happened in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So she is one of she's one of nine children, and her parents first send the eldest two brothers, child number one, child number two. And then after they leave North to South Korea, they establish themselves in Seoul. Mm-hmm. And then the next two that get sent are number three, number four, which is my mother's elder sister and her.
Okay.
And so they make this harrowing journey to the South. And I think what's really tragic about the story, there's so many tragedies around the story, is that they fully assumed that the rest of the family would follow.
Right.
One, two, three, four. Well, here come the rest, and here come mom and dad. And because of circumstances and because of timing, the rest of the family was never able to follow. So that means that my mother at 14 said goodbye to her parents.
Wow.
At 14. My kids are 17 and 19.
Yeah.
And same thing with all of her siblings. She said goodbye to all of her siblings. And I think that, you know, many, many, many of us who come from all over the different places in the world, many of us have stories like this, whether you're a refugee, you know, whether you seek asylum. There are so many stories of fleeing your country. And then she met my father at the University of Seoul, at Seoul University, Seoul National University, and they fell in love. And like many of my parents' generation, they got married and they had kids. And my father had a friend at University of British Columbia in Vancouver who was in the mathematics department, and he knew that my father was extremely gifted and invited him to do his get his PhD there. And so my father did his PhD, went back. My brother was born in Korea, and then my father came back to UBC and taught, and then my mother followed, and then I was born in Vancouver.
Wow.
So that your dad just kind of figured that Vancouver was the place for him.
I think so. And I think, too, that for many of our parents, these decisions are predicated on what they think will be best for their children.
Right.
Even if the children are not here yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really really true. I think a lot of children of immigrants take that for granted. Like the decision of our parents were for it's everything was for us. Everything. Whether it's where the school system is, whether it's the city and which country. I think it's all about where they think their family will be thriving the most.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even if that means to leave everything behind, learn a new language in exactly. the middle of their life. Like
exactly. In the middle of their lives. Yeah. Exactly. It's a huge sacrifice.
Yeah, it's a huge sacrifice. And I think it is interesting that, I mean, what you said, it's true. Like a lot of immigrants, there's generations of trauma and generations of fleeing and escape.
Yeah.
And I think that that's... I think the older generations would kind of like put that aside and not be weak about it and kind of be like, this is just the way it is. But I do think it's important to kind of reconcile.
Yeah. I mean, I read this tweet that was really beautiful. And this woman said, my parents were tasked with survival and I'm tasked with self-actualization. I'm paraphrasing, but, and of course she's a child of immigrants. And I read that and I thought, that is so true. Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever talk to your parents about their happiness? Mm. Never for me. Mm-mm. That was, no. Did you even, it didn't even, no. Did you even mm-mm. think about it?
No.
Of course we didn't. Did you even think about your parents' internal lives? I did not.
No. But they also don't really give you an opening, you know?
That's true. Yeah.
We're not raised with like emotional awareness and or intelligence.
That's right. Yeah. And the vocabulary,
yeah.
right? Whereas for me, because I am now Canadian and so my culture, I am culturally also Canadian, North American, mm-hmm. right? And it's my language. And so I have conversations with my children that are very open and yeah. emotional. And I think that I kind of feel like we are a bridge generation.
Yeah. I think so too. I think
yeah.
as an adult, I've had more of those conversations with my parents about like, how do you feel? Like, how mm-hmm. are you okay? Mm-hmm. And I think that it catches them off guard a little bit. You have to kind of train them to be like, I want to talk about our emotions. Because
yeah.
we weren't ever asked that growing up.
Exactly.
And it's just, yeah. it's crazy how similar so many marginalized communities are. It's not just Middle Eastern parents or Asian parents. It's so many marginalized communities, especially that come to different countries and just try to survive.
Yes.
That part of that survival is like a defense mechanism to be like, we're not going to talk about anything deep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I still have that problem with my mom. Like her dad just died recently and I was like, are you okay? And she was just like, yeah, you know. These things happen.
Yeah,
and you're right. Like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, yeah. come on, Mom. Like, give me. And I literally said, Mom, it's okay. You can tell me how you feel. And she's like, you know, it's tough. You don't really have time to be sad because you have to keep moving. And, you know, like, mm-hmm. I have to keep working. And,
yeah.
you know, I gotta go to Iran and see the family and make sure everyone's okay. Because she's also the oldest child. So in her mind, she's like, I still have to make sure everything's okay. Mm-hmm. I have to go deal with how the inheritance is going to get split up. Like, mm-hmm. I don't have time to sit around and be sad. Yeah. I just have to keep moving. And yeah. it's like, that's their whole thing is work ethic.
It's that immigrant work ethic. Yeah. And it's just, you know, you plug away. You know, I talk about it in my memoir. I only saw my mother cry twice, and that's mm-hmm. when I was younger. Mm-hmm. My mother did not cry when my father died.
Wow.
She did not cry at his funeral. I never saw her cry, and I never thought, oh, heart of stone, cold as ice, you didn't love our father. Of course she did.
Yeah.
And of course she felt it deeply, but it's just this, you know, I think about, oh, okay, you left your family when you were 14. You never saw them again. And she's just this warrior. You know,
right.
they have this spirit and they gave us this comfort. Aziz Ansari deals with this really beautiful in one of his episodes of Master of None in the first season of Master of None. He also talks about it in his stand-up special, you know, talking about his mother coming to town. And, you know, the other thing is, I don't know about you guys, but for my parents, English was not their first language.
No, mm-hmm. not at all.
And they spoke with heavy accents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he tells a story of the phone ringing and his mother being petrified of picking up the phone because she didn't master the language.
Yeah.
It's also infuriating because people that don't speak another language will hear someone with an accent and just assume they're an idiot.
Right.
When really it's like they're so much smarter than you, even trying to attempt to communicate to you.
Exactly.
Especially, I'm sure, with your dad being a professor. I'm sure he encountered that plenty of times.
I'm sure he
with
did.
Students being frustrated.
I'm sure he did. Yeah.
It's just like,
yeah.
it's, yeah. I remember hearing kids talk about professors with accents when I was in college, and I would always get so mad and defensive because I would think of my parents.
Yes.
My dad has a business now, and like I want people to take him seriously.
Yes.
And not just assume, like, just because he mispronounces one word.
Yes. Assume ignorance. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I mean, I feel the same way. I used to say that my parents didn't speak perfect English, and I thought, you know what? I'm not saying that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because what does that mean?
Yeah.
Right? So my mother still mixes up pronouns because many of the Asian languages, like in Korean and Chinese, you don't necessarily have,
yeah,
the,
you don't have
the he and the she.
Mm-hmm. That's right? How it is in Farsi as
well. Oh, it's the same.
Yeah, they don't have that.
And so do your folks sometimes mix up pronouns?
Yeah, my dad does it all the time. My mom's a little better because I think she's just more, she just cares more, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But my, you know, my mother still does it.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, my mother and father read the great classics in English.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They read fucking Tolstoy.
Yeah.
In English, right? They read Dickens. They read Austen in English. And so who am I to say, because they speak with an accent and because they might mess up pronouns, that they don't speak perfect English, especially compared to people who speak quote-unquote perfect English.
Yeah.
And
What are they representing?
Like,
you know what I mean? It's just like, who are they? Why are they the...
Right. And they could be raging ignoramai. Mm-hmm. Ignoramai, yeah. Is that the plural for ignoramus?
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. I think crying is something really interesting to bring up because, like, I've only heard my dad cry one time.
Me and that too. Was when, and what happened?
We got a phone call that his mother had passed in Syria. Mm-hmm. And I heard him cry in the other room and I was petrified. I ran the other direction.
Yes.
That is,
and we never talked about it, and because prior to that, it was during the kind of like a lot of turmoil in Syria a couple of years ago, and he was debating between going there and seeing her on her deathbed.
Oh no!
And in the middle of that, he got this phone call, and
so it was exacerbated by guilt too.
It was a lot of, and he was very close to her, and she was just the matriarch, and his dad had passed when he was 17, and mm-hmm. so she was the thing that was heavy, holding everything together.
Yeah,
and I didn't know what the phone call was until I heard him, like, sobbing.
Moan, right?
Or, yes. Yeah, it wasn't even a sob. It was just, I can't even understand why I got so scared, but I did, and I couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
No, you don't have a normal reaction. Like, the only time I ever saw my dad cry was at his brother's funeral in Iran, and I was standing next to him, and he had covered his face, because we were outside and it was snowing, and he had covered his face with his glove, and I could hear him, like, sobbing. Like, my dad is just, like, a hard stone, like, very, like, strict man. Mm-hmm. And to watch him cry, like, I literally was just staring at him, like, mouth agape, like, whoa.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know how to take it in. I was like, this guy doesn't cry. Yeah. He doesn't have emotions. Yeah. He there's just follow the rules and, you know, don't wear short skirts, you know, like there's no much more. It's just like, just follow the rules and don't upset him and don't show him that you're showing cleavage. And like, that's it.
Exactly,
like, I don't know anything else.
But but the flip side of that is that I'm a huge crybaby. And like, growing up, I was the sensitive one. I was always the one that was just like very emotional. And I think having a kid like that, like, especially with parents that don't have they're not equipped to handle that.
Yeah.
I think it makes the immigrant child feel so much more alone than they already do.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if that child wants to go into different fields, whether it's music, whether it's art, filmmaking, whatever. I think there are so many factors that kind of stem from a lack of emotional upbringing and then kind of goes to where, I don't know. I'm still a crybaby.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I cry a lot. Yeah.
Me too. But I'm not ashamed, and I actually enjoy it. I find
it's cathartic.
It
very cathartic.
Absolutely cathartic, and I just love the release. And I cry sadness. I cry for grief, but I also cry for joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can look at my children and just them doing nothing in particular and just start crying.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my God.
I cried the other day looking at a tree. I don't know why. I just was like, this is a great tree.
Yeah.
And then I realized, like, oh, I'm just bubbling with emotion over years of repressing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all coming out now. Compensate.
Yeah. I know, like, years of therapy being like, why am I so emotional? My therapist being like, well, have you met your parents?
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, when your father decided to come to Vancouver full time, like, did your mom have much input, or was she just ready to kind of like move along with her life?
It's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah.
My guess is, as progressive as my father was, and he was extremely progressive, both my parents were, it probably wasn't much of a discussion. You know, I doubt that there was much of a debate. And my mother, already having made such a huge trek, you know, massive transition from North to South Korea and leaving her family behind, I don't think it would have been daunting.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh my God, I can't. Well, you've already made this massive, massive journey.
Right. What's in one more continent?
Right, exactly.
Well, I'm just curious if she was like kind of like scared to leave Korea because now you have like another step if your family wanted you ever wanted to see your family in North Korea. Like you've left South Korea, so now it's even harder for them to see you in Canada.
Right.
I guess that's what you let go of.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question I'd have to ask her. But I think they understood really quickly that they would be incommunicado.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Yeah. That's a tough life to think about.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I'm not very, very happy though. No. We're going to take one commercial break, our first commercial break. We'll be right back with Sophia Chang. And we're back. So you mentioned earlier that you moved to New York. What did you tell your parents you were going to do in New York?
I didn't. and to your point, it also wasn't a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, Dad, Hesok, I'm thinking of moving to New York. And, you know, let's talk about the pros and cons. I just said I was going to do it, mm-hmm, which in retrospect seems remarkably selfish.
Well, in your book, you said you were just going for like 6 months or something.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. I thought that maybe that was the case. I didn't have a plan. I mean, I had met, as you hear in my memoir, I had met Joey Ramone. He had introduced me to his friend, this music journalist, Lex McNeil. I slept on Lex and Carol's couch. And then I got this job at Paul Simon. But coming to New York, getting on that plane, I didn't know what my plan was. I just said, you know what? I'm just going to go. Mm-hmm. Now, look, I have always had and still have a middle-class safety net. I have the privilege mm-hmm. of a middle-class safety net. So it's not like you're going to go, Sophia, and then you could just end up, you know, sleeping on the streets. That wasn't going to happen. That said, I hope that what listeners gleaned from my memoir is that I'm pretty fucking fearless.
Mm-hmm.
And
I definitely got that.
Oh, yeah. You did? Thank you. And just kind of not, like, I don't really care if I fail.
Yeah.
Okay, so New York doesn't work out, so I go home, or maybe I go to another city. But I didn't really have a plan, but I did know that music was the thing that impassioned me. I was a French lit major, and I love French literature, but that wasn't the thing that was, like, really at my core and, had me, like, burning with passion.
Did you ever have a desire to pursue it yourself, or was it more—
As a musician?
Yeah.
No. I mean, as a Korean, I took piano because it was either piano or violin.
Right.
And I was not good, and I would fall asleep. I feel so badly. Like, I literally fell asleep in my piano lessons. It's me and this woman sitting next to me, and it's just the two of us and 88 keys. And I remember, like, nodding off. Oh, God, that's so rude. So, no, I never had musical aspirations myself, but I always loved being music and artist adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the world that I found so enthralling, whether it was the studio or shows or just, you know, kind of anywhere in the midst of their creative process.
Yeah. I want to go back to Vancouver before we get back into New York.
Mm-hmm.
You're this Korean-Canadian child in Vancouver, and, you know, you're being raised by immigrants. Like, what was your experience like in the neighborhood? Like, was Vancouver a tough place to grow up as an Asian child, or?
I think that it wasn't as tough as some of my friends who grew up and they were the only Asian family, mm-hmm. you know, somewhere in Texas or somewhere right. in, mm-hmm. you know, Kansas. Vancouver, there are a lot of Chinese people there.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that Vancouver will, if it is not already, will be the first city in North America to have an Asian majority, which includes South Asians.
Okay.
And so there were lots of people, there were lots of Chinese people in particular. But even with that, you know, in 1975, I'm 10 years old, mm-hmm. and I'm still getting called chink and mm-hmm. Jap and gook. The racism was overt.
Mm-hmm.
And even after I moved to New York, I heard that. And it was always kind of stunning to me. And it's just this thing, like, someone, like, gets this ice ball, and they make this ice ball, and they just throw it in your face.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no subtlety to it. And so it was always very clear to me that I was other.
Uh-huh.
I was never allowed to forget that. As smart as I was, as popular and well-dressed and all of that, I still knew.
Yeah. I think that carries on to now, I think. I don't think any of us will ever not know we're another. We walk into any room and it's obvious.
Exactly.
Do you think that's where your kind of fearlessness is born from?
I think that's a huge part of it. Yeah. I think it's the machine against which I rage every day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is white supremacy, patriarchy, misogyny, just feeling like I know what your expectations are of me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying there aren't women out there who are like that. And that's totally fine. There are plenty of people that fulfill the model minority myth because that's who they are to their core. That's no shade. Mm-hmm. But I'm not. And what I find enraging is the preconceived notion, which is what racism is, right? That I am going to be this thing because I am an Asian woman. And I think that absolutely, once I decided that I was not going to just take it lying down, you kind of get emboldened. It's kind of like a video game where you just keep picking up points and weapons and stuff, and it just gets easier and easier. I'm always telling my mentees, for whatever it is, whether it's standing up for yourself or defending others or networking, the more you do it, the easier it gets. And, you know, it's experiential like everything else, to the point such that not saying something for me is more difficult than raising my voice.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. I wish I was that. I feel like I grew up in a very similar fashion. Less racism, more just like, aren't you a terrorist? Or like, especially after 9/11, it was like anytime I picked up a laser gun.
But that's racist, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty racist. But I was never called any racial slurs to my face.
Sure.
As a child, I was just kind of the only Iranian girl in a mostly Asian neighborhood, actually. So a lot of people.
Interesting. Far East Asian. Yeah, Chinese, Japanese, Korean.
Yeah. Actually, mostly Filipino.
Me too, actually. Interesting.
Really?
Both of my community was Filipino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. I don't know why. It was just the neighborhood we happened to live
in. But it was, I think it was still mostly, it was like white, Filipino.
White.
And then,
strange. Yeah. But I feel like I'm still so timid in my life, and I wish I was more fearless. But I always find myself, and I don't know if just because I grew up with very strict parents who never really like told me like you're doing great.
Right.
So I find myself like second guessing everything I do.
I think I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit, because I think even if both of us having this podcast,
exactly.
I think it's like
But I still don't know what I'm doing.
I don't know what the fuck I'm doing at any point in my time. But like, I think all of us, we are putting ourselves in a situation where we have to represent ourselves because there wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. Like, if no one else is going to represent us, we'll just do it our fucking selves.
Right.
And I think there's a fearlessness to that. I would love to, if I was going to die tomorrow, I would love to, for one person to be like, she was fearless. Because I think deep down in my core, I do think there's a part of, there's a fearlessness to everything that we do just by being a person of color out here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess so. And I think it's hard to admit that because of our upbringing and because we kind of, I feel like the deadbeat of the family by being like a quote unquote filmmaker, even in quotes, I'm just a filmmaker, no, whatever, I should just embody that.
Right.
But I mean, like, I think there's like, we have to talk ourselves out of putting ourselves down because maybe our parents have put on expectations of us of what our life should have been.
Right.
And we're deviating so far from that. But I think we're all fearless. But I think we just have to really believe that rather than, and like know that like our actions and like putting ourselves and using our voices to raise an awareness is an act of rebellion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that for us as women of color to be standing up and asking to be heard and seen, I think that's an act of rebellion. I mean, think about the fact that I am a 54-year-old Korean Canadian single mother of two grown teenagers who has this crazy samurai hairdo.
It's amazing.
And, thank you. Cool.
It's even more amazing in person, though. It's great.
And I am jumping on a table and pounding my fist and telling the world that I'm the baddest bitch in the room.
Yeah.
That's radical to me.
Yeah.
It's subversive. And I think that, you know, what I think about a lot lately, you guys, is erasure. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have this podcast, and if you didn't take the time and the care and the thoughtfulness to talk about the issues that you talk about, many of us risk being erased.
Right.
And not just you. Right? I mean,
this is just one example.
Exactly. Of, yeah. But you're also speaking to and on behalf of a lot of people, even though that might not be what you're setting out to do. I'm sure there are a lot of people saying, oh my God, Shireen and Anna, they're giving me voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the feedback that I'm getting from my audiobook that is the most profound, is that you're expressing my story.
Yeah,
I felt that way. I mean, within the first chapter of you describing like your mom's story and then growing up in like your early years in Vancouver, I was like, no, you're nailing this immigrant experience or children of immigrant experience pretty early on. I think I texted that to you. Yeah. I was like, she kind of nails it. Yeah. Like I was like,
But that's so crazy. That's the crazy thing is just how unifying that experience is, regardless of where we come from.
Yes.
And I think you're right about the we can do like 20 episodes of this podcast and then we'll get one message where it's like, thank you so much. I feel seen.
Yes.
And I'll be like, it's all worth it.
Yes.
It's all worth it. Yes. Just for that. Even if it was only one person in the years we did it, it would be worth it.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that about my filmmaking. I feel like that about anything I do. I just, if it reaches one person, that's the whole fucking point.
Yes. You want to touch people. Yeah. You want to inspire people. You want to embolden people to live a more fully actualized version of themselves. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what you guys are doing with this. And it's really, really important.
Yeah.
And well, so I think that that's really intrepid.
Yeah. It's hard to see outside yourself
sometimes.
I love
that Sophia's like giving us therapy. I
know. Tell us more.
Keep going. Okay, let's go back to Sophia. Yeah. You're able to flip the tables pretty well, which is not easy. And or do you want the show?
Do you want to host the show?
Do you want to be our co-host?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you're in New York.
I'm in New York.
You're in New York. Can you walk us through a little bit like how you worked your way into something that you're like, oh, I can do this for a job? Like what was that moment where you were like, I can live like this?
So you know, getting into the club scene that I described to you, that was very small. I met this guy named the Captain Sean Karasov, God rest his soul. And he did A&R at Jive, meaning he was a talent scout at Jive Records. And he said, you know, Sophia, I'm moving to the West Coast. I think you should apply for my job. And I didn't think that I could do it.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I, you know, again, I'm saying I'm a Korean Canadian French lit major. And I, you know, I am in a world that is not mine. And meaning hip hop, right? And so he said, no, you've got to interview, And he set up an interview with his boss, Barry Weiss, who ran Jive Records. So smart, so funny, one of the best record company people I've ever seen. And Barry told me that the second I walked in the door, he's like, she's never going to get the job. Mm. And then we talked for an hour and a half. And by the end of it, you know, I asked him recently, I said, Barry, why did you hire me? And he said, because you were so fully ensconced in the community. And you were so passionate that that's why I gave you the job. But I did have doubts about it even once I got the job.
Yeah.
You know, one of my artists recently said to me, you know, Sophia, I remember you used to say that you weren't sure that you had a rightful place because you're an Asian woman. And I never understood that. But I definitely suffered from imposter syndrome.
Oh my God, that's my
welcome to
my
club. Main thing.
Exactly, all of us, all of us.
The subtitle of under everything I do is just imposter fraud alert.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then once I started doing the job, and once I was signing good talent, and then trying to sign good talent and not getting to sign it, that is also significant. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I wanted to sign this group called Das Effects, and I wasn't able to sign them. I wanted to sign House of Pain. I wasn't able to sign them. And so those are all notches on your belt, so to speak, because even if I wasn't able to sign them, the, you know, the owner of the company is like, well, you have carte blanche now because clearly you a certain talent for this and you've got an ear for it. And, you know, A&R back in the day was very different than it is now. So back in the day in hip hop, the best way to find talent was through other talent. You know, so any of the artists, they're all hanging out with other artists. Any of the producers are hanging out with other producers who are hanging out with other artists. And so that was the proximity, you know, the kind of community and the proximity that would always take you to the best talent. And it's some of that is the same now, but a lot of it now is based on data.
Interesting.
Okay. Like listens because of the and stuff.
Yeah. Because of the internet, because yeah. you can yeah. literally quantify it. Everything's yeah. O's yeah. and ones, right?
Well, that was wow. what's fascinating to me about your story is that you were pre-internet. Like, it, like yeah, a lot absolutely. Of the stuff was like how,
yeah, you went yeah. out. Well, that's when you were saying you didn't think you could do it. In my mind, I was like, well, you were qualified. You were going out every single night and seeing a, yeah. like music, and you were dancing, and you were seeing different bands. Like, I right. believe you said there was one band you saw like 8 times.
Yeah,
like you
I
were,
saw Fishbone so Fishbone, many times. Yes. Yeah,
you were out here, literally out here.
Yes.
Yeah. So like that's isn't that like what you're supposed yeah. to be like? You were you know everyone. You could you had you were getting into like the clubs that didn't let anyone yes. in.
Yeah.
Like you
yeah.
could just walk through because yeah. they knew who you were. Like isn't that that qualifies you?
No, you know what? That's a good point. That's a good observation. And but you know it's not just being on the scene and having your finger on the pulse. I think right. part of it is also knowing how to woo an artist.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes the deals would get competitive mm-hmm. and you would have more than one label trying to sign an artist. And then even once you sign the artist, you know, that's just the very first of the hurdles. Then you have to facilitate them making an album. Yeah. And then once the album is made, you have to shepherd it through the label system. So there are two parts of an album. The first part of it is recording, and they're separate, they're discrete budgets. The first part is recording, and the second part is marketing. And I didn't do marketing, but you're still the general.
You're part of the whole process.
You're,
from
right,
start
like
to
you're
finish.
Shepherding it yeah. through, and you're making sure that your artist yeah. and that album gets the attention. It's a pretty varied skill set, and I think I learned that I had that skill set.
Well, what? How did you feel when you were first coming up, interacting with artists face to face as an Asian woman? Maybe them not having seen someone like you approach
Absolutely.
Them. I'm sure you must have seen it in their eyes. I feel like.
I think that sometimes there was a little bit of surprise, but in general, you guys, I felt so much more welcomed in hip hop than I did anywhere else.
Wow.
Even to this day.
Yeah.
I think that hip hop embraces me more even than my own community. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's about what they could see. So many of the artists that I worked with, they were of a very specific profile. Black men grew up in challenging financial circumstances. Many of them had a criminal past. And what I learned really quickly about the artists that I dealt with is that their instincts were spot on. They could read people very quickly. Mm-hmm. Because there were probably times where reading somebody quickly could literally be mm-hmm. a life or death scenario. And I think that what they saw in me was somebody who was passionate, truthful, and loyal. Mm-hmm. And that sounds maybe banal, and there should be a lot of people like that, but I don't think there are. And if you listen, when you get to the end of my audiobook, I have this bonus content, and I have these really, to me, it's some of the best content of my audiobook, frankly. And I have this amazing conversation with Raekwon and Ghostface from Wu-Tang, and we talk specifically about why me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, just this little Korean-Canadian girl, like you pulled me out of a crowd and you put me in your pocket, your breast yeah. pocket, and you always carried me with you. And I think that the quick embrace, you know, when I talk about the New Music Seminar in the early 90s, pre-Wu-Tang, right? It was the first people I remember meeting in hip-hop were Crazy Legs, who was a founder of the legendary B-Boy crew, right? The Rocksteady B-Boy crew, and then DJ Scratch, who was the best turntablist in the world to this day. And they immediately just took to me. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, so sometimes there were raised eyebrows, but far more than that were embraces. And, you know, being in the hip hop scene back in that era was a privilege. It was a profound privilege to be welcomed into that scene. Again, not of my making.
That's beautiful to hear.
It's interesting because when I think of like hip hop, just the community, like it kind of created or it was started, it feels like, by people who were othered.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yes.
they were like, your music doesn't fit in. Your beats are weird. They're too pop. Like it was just
it's
like
not
all these,
music.
Yeah. Like yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not music. Like, what are you doing? You're not singing. You're
right.
Like,
right.
what
yeah.
is
what
that?
Is this thing? Yeah.
Yeah. So it kinda, I don't know. It makes sense that someone who has kind of lived a not like you haven't grown up like the traditional, you know, American or Canadian, like I don't know, like what I want to say, like a white family. Like,
right.
I'm not surprised that they were like, you have good vibes. Mm-hmm. You're not like you don't come with this kind of pretension of I should be accepted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like you yeah. come in and you're like, hey, like this is what I can offer.
Right.
I believe in you and I believe I can help you and I want to make your art, like I want more people to know about your art. Yeah. And I think that I think that's very, and I'm coming from this, like I started my career in comedy working as a talent booker.
Oh, okay.
And I would produce live shows. Uh-huh. And that's how I made all my networking, is by going out every night and like going to comedy shows and producing my own shows. Mm-hmm. And like meeting a bunch of people. And it was like the same concept of like, I have to make these comedians who, you know, can be a little fickle sometimes,
right,
feel like I care.
That you care. Mm-hmm. And yeah. that you're passionate about yeah. their gift yeah. and their art.
Yeah. And that was, you know, and it's weird at first because some comedians are weird, but like you find a way to make it work. And right. I don't know. I feel like those kind of communities come from like being othered.
Yes, you're like, I agree.
I've grew up in a certain way, and what I like to do is make people laugh because it makes me feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have to wear your whole entire self on your sleeve.
I think mm-hmm. that's right.
And I think it's very interesting to point out that because of their backgrounds, they have to have a certain heightened sense of interpersonal communication. Like they can read you
yeah.
so much better than yes. like the average person
yes.
because they've been through actual struggle yes. and strife.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It comes out of necessity.
Yeah. yeah.
So
yeah.
I think they can sense your pure self on your sleeve, and mm-hmm. that vulnerability is just implicitly there, mm-hmm. just because not even on purpose. You don't mean for it to be there.
Right.
But there's a certain connection that does happen when you've both been othered and forced to survive in a certain way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Should we take a yeah. quick break on that? All right. We'll be right back with Sophia. And we are back. This wasn't one of those short breaks. We actually did things.
We actually did things. We never do that.
We took a true ad break.
Yeah.
We rarely do that because
we, I don't know why.
We have nothing going on. Just this podcast. Well, we are back.
We're back.
With the baddest bitch in the room. In current state.
That is still a fact.
Yeah.
That is still a fact. I am
terrified.
Trina
and I are little cornballs.
Oh, man.
So yeah. We ended it. You were still in New York, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Well, you haven't left. So who was the first artist you signed?
The first artist I signed was a group of three West Indian MCs from Brooklyn, from Flatbush, and they were called the Fushnikins.
Oh, wow.
And they were, their whole aesthetic was kung fu.
Yeah.
Coincidentally. Yeah, as well.
In the beginning, actually, what I wanted to touch on that I blanked on in the moment, but when you were saying that you were, it wasn't hard to be accepted. There is a story you tell. I think it's like your cold open, if you will.
Yeah, the Method Man's story
yeah,
in the studio.
Yeah, where yeah. someone is like, where are you from?
Yes.
And you were like, well, that's a loaded question.
Yes, yes.
And then Method Man kind of stood up for you and was like, leave her alone. She's with me.
Or, yes.
Actually, did they all record? Did they all come in to record that? Or did you just have them like record?
I went to them.
Oh.
Yeah.
And sorry, to give context, she has like Method Man and different people in her life record their own lines or things they've said.
It's a really amazing audiobook for that reason.
Thank also, you. Your mother does her own lines, yeah. which is like,
isn't that so cute?
I couldn't get my mom to.
It's more. It's less of an audiobook and more just like kind
it
of like
feels
a play
like a podcast.
Or a podcast.
Or, yeah, that's what I was
or like
thinking.
Some type of like interactive like story that I'm listening. It's not
Thank
like
you.
Just you. Telling like reading off of a page. It's like you made an effort for it to be really engaging, and like it's obvious you've maintained these connections because you literally have them in this book.
I yeah. do. Thank you. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess my other question is, who is your favorite or the artist you're most proud of that you signed?
That I signed?
Yeah.
Probably, I mean, I didn't sign that many because I wasn't at Jive for very long.
Okay.
But probably Souls of Mischief.
Souls of Mischief.
Wow. They're part
That's
of this Oakland collective yes. called Hieroglyphics.
Don't we know? I'm from that area.
Oh, That's, there you go.
There you go.
And I think that their creativity, you know, there were four of them, and the fact that they, you know, did their own production. And they wrote this song, 93 till Infinity, mm-hmm. that...
And drop it. I wish I could.
Exactly. Is infinity.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you still hear it today, and it gets licensed all the time. I mean, yeah. I think it was the first song. It's the song that opened Always Be My Maybe, Ali Wong's movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
because
yeah,
it takes place in the Bay.
It takes place in the Bay, yeah. the next song, I think it was D'Angelo. I was like, oh, I've worked with both of those artists.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Souls of Mischief just played in LA, like the Grant Free concerts. Okay, that's just a tangent. I was just thinking of that. Also, Hyro Day just passed.
Yeah.
Labor Day.
I've never actually been, but it's huge.
I used to go.
It's big,
when I
right?
was young. Yeah. We wanted to go recently, but I just couldn't make it work. But it's grown significantly, and now it's a whole weekend.
Yeah.
It's the best. That's like when you grow up as a kid in the Bay, and it's something I've kind of learned or just kind of realized as I become more self-aware as a person and gone to therapy. But like when you're like a kid of color, you either go towards what the whites like or
right.
what like anyone else yeah. likes or right. like any like African-Americans. Like yeah. you just go in that direction. And me and my brother, because we were raised in the Bay Area, so naturally we went towards like we would watch BET. Like that's what our music was.
Yeah.
We really liked hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And Hieroglyphics was like just that whole world, like just Dell and the whole just the whole team. Like it was like these are people who come from our world. Like they're not like anyone else. Like it was just like
absolutely unique.
That was our childhood. Like yeah. we were yeah. like, hey man, I'm Del the funky homo sapien. Like,
yeah.
I remember my brother would always hear that, would be like, you're Iranian, relax.
Yeah.
But like that was, I don't know, that's so, I don't know why the Souls of Mischief, that's such a, that song is like my child. Like I have heard that song.
So you've got, there's a lot of nostalgia there for you.
Yeah.
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 There's a lot. It's crazy. I don't
it's
know.
A beautiful
that's
song.
That whole era, just growing up in like Oakland, Berkeley, and like my parents being like, you can't go to public school because you'll join a gang. And we'd be like, what? Like, just like that weird inherent racism that
yes.
immigrants tend
yes,
to have
yes.
that you're like, okay, yeah,
okay,
I'm
right.
not going to join
don't
a gang.
So.
I'll probably take photography. Like, that's
yeah.
it's not that crazy. But like, we had to have these like secret lives where we just listened to hip hop,
mm-hmm.
like to a point where like, you know, my mom kind of caught on because she's just very perceptive, but she would literally be like, are you listening to your Hieroglyphics?
Are you serious?
Yeah, like she would, because she just picks up on these things. So she'll just be like, oh, and you like your Snoop Dogg? Like that's,
oh my God,
but she
that's
says
so
in her
cute.
Like thick, like yes. Iranian accent, but she just,
so cute.
It was just so funny because it's like to her as well. She's like, yes, my children love that group.
Yes.
But it was always, that's what we grew up on. That's all we knew.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, I can't even think of like a white group. I don't know.
I mean,
but.
Like, I think you're right that a lot of othered, quote unquote, kids or like children of immigrants, they do gravitate towards other, like not necessarily what the whites like.
Right.
It's always the other thing.
Yeah.
For me and my sisters, it was some hip hop, but we really liked Japanese rock and Korean rock, which was like completely nerdy back then as far as like what white kids were into. But regardless, did your mom ever try to understand what you were doing or like what you were trying to make a career out of?
I mean, until I wrote this book, I don't think my mother could ever fully describe what I do. Can your parents?
Mm-mm. Not really.
Yeah, exactly. Like no. if they sit with their friends yeah. at the buffet and they're eating king crab legs.
Oh no, you know. They talk about my older sister who's a doctor.
Buffet is
that's
so
right.
Real.
They talk about my right.
Yeah.
They talk
yeah.
about my brother who's yeah. he's an English professor at Vassar.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
so simple.
Yeah. yeah.
She tried, but I think what was more important, Shireen, than my mother trying to understand the machinations of my job was her wanting to understand hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
I have this very very clear memory of going back to Vancouver and playing her The Streets of New York by Kool G Rap. And it's poetry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this beautiful song that just talks about this is my reality. And I had it in this little cassette player and I would play it and I would stop and then I would tell her what the line was and I would explain it because,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's slang and,
yeah.
you know, English
yeah.
is my mother's second language. And she just sat there and she was so attentive. And so caring, and she completely understood why it would impassion me. And I think that that was one of my favorite memories of her being like, I get it. I mean,
yeah.
I'm the child that they raised.
Yeah.
You know, like
mm-hmm.
I said, my parents were extremely progressive. So it's not like, you know, they were like, oh, no, what are you doing,
no.
you know, working with those artists? Yeah.
She saw
totally
the beauty. She heard the beauty.
She did. And
yeah.
and I think, Shireen, what was important is that even as herself, even though she may not have, it may not have resonated with her, it resonated via me.
Mm-hmm.
So what was important to her was that this was something that her daughter cared about.
Right.
And that was her appreciation of it.
I like that a lot. I like that. That memory is probably,
wow.
I don't know. It's beautiful.
That's Thank a nice you. Moment to share with your parents.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could do that with our podcast.
I mean, I kind of felt that moment with my mom last year. One of my short films screened at the MoMA in New York.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. It was a highlight of my year / life. But my mom had never seen a film of mine in a theater. I had never. Actually, I had never either. Mm-hmm. It was a moment that I wanted to share with her. And she had never been to New York. Mm. So that whole trip was me kind of like showing her around New York, acting as tour guide, but also like exploring with her and like seeing her face light up when she saw the Central Park and everything. And then we sat down and saw the film, and I think she realized, like, oh, like, my daughter likes to create things. Like, yeah. She, like, this is, everyone is here, like, a sold-out theater to see one of her films. Like, this is, like, I think there are moments where I can remember my parents kind of get it, or whether it's, like, if I was reading poetry that night or something, or, like, I think they're few and far between, and it's not that they have to understand why I do it. I think my mom would much rather me, like, still go to law school or something.
Sure.
But I think that we are their children. We are the children that they raised. And deep down, they do know us.
Yes.
Whether it's their memories of us being emotional or unable to communicate or whatever, and then finally seeing us communicate in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Those are the moments that I cherish the most. It's not exactly like them being able to articulate what I do to like their friends.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's more just like, even after years of maybe not support, there's understanding and eventual support is better than nothing at all, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like they never realize that they think because, oh, whatever, you don't become the lawyer, doctor, engineer, that they haven't instilled that same work ethic in us. Mm-hmm. It's like, even if we go become podcasters, we're still going to go at it with the same level of intensity.
150%. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's like, I know the situation. I know I have to succeed, or you guys are going to be giving me hell for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, that's the math equation. It's like, you either succeed or they will never leave you alone. Mm-hmm. And like, once you get that health insurance, then they're like, okay, I guess I understand what you're doing. Yeah. And you're
like, no, but it is true. That work ethic is instilled in anything we do. And that's because we just have watched them. It's not like they told us, like, you will work hard forever.
Yeah, it's more just like osmosis. We saw. Of course. Yeah.
We saw how hard they worked as immigrants.
Yeah.
Yeah. And coming to, you know, their like America or Canada, like they had to learn a whole new way of life. And
it's hard.
That takes balls.
That's fearlessness. That's fearlessness inherited.
No question. Yeah.
And I think that's something that I really admire my parents for. And every immigrant parent is just like, it's fearlessness inherited. That's why like the majority of the people we on this podcast, we have majority people of color, women of color, and across the board, it's the same thing where it's like we worked hard because we saw our parents do. Like, it's just, it's inherited. It's just, that's what we were meant to do.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's something really beautiful.
So before we close out the show, I want to get more into your book. Mm-hmm. So what led you to write the book?
People have been telling me for years that I should write a book. Oh, you're the first Asian woman in hip hop. Oh, you hung out with Wu-Tang Clan. You managed Old Dirty Bastard, God rest his soul. And I couldn't figure out how to make that not a book about hanging out with famous people.
Right.
And that's not a book that I'm interested in writing. Mm-hmm. Nor reading, to be frank.
And that's not even what your life is, really.
Exactly.
To boil it down to that
Right. Yeah. It's very reductive.
Yeah.
So I started working at Universal Music Group in 2014. I took on a number of women as mentees, young, 22, fresh out of college. And at this point, I'm 50, and I realize, oh, okay, my experience as a 50-year-old woman who's been in this industry, who's also worked in other disciplines, who is a mother, who is a single working mother, could actually be beneficial and be instructive for these women. So that was one of the catalysts. Another catalyst was Lean In came out. And I don't know if you guys have read Lean In.
I haven't read it, but I know.
And so, look, there's obviously pearls of wisdom in there, but she's not writing from our perspective nor to us necessarily. And then I was here in LA for the LA Film Festival. During the LA Film Festival, they have something called Fast Track. And Fast Track is like speed dating. And our project, this movie about Chrissy Hynde, got chosen. And what you do is you pitch. You have 10 to 15 minutes to pitch, and you're just going. And then as soon as you're done, boom, you're on to the next, right? And you're pitching, I don't know, 30, 40 people over 2 days. And so my producing partner and the writer / director said, okay, you know what? We should open each of our pitches with just a 60-second CV, right, with our resumes.
Yeah.
And 70% of the time after I'd given my resume, the people across from us, the buyers, said, that's the movie.
Yeah.
And pointed at me. And by the end of the day, you guys, I was like, I'm fucking making a documentary about myself. Like, and it took,
yeah.
it took, like you're saying, it's not easy to see yourself, mm-hmm. right? It took that for those people to kind of summarily, you know, this is what they do for a living, okay, mm-hmm. is they listen to people pitch stories and decide whether or not they're going to fund them. Mm-hmm. And to have the vast majority of them look at me and say, yours is the story, when that isn't even what we were pitching, that was really a turning point for me. Mm-hmm. And because I'd already been thinking about it in terms of a book, that's what happened. And God put me on this earth to do public speaking. There's no doubt in my mind. I'm supposed to be in an arena. I've talked to Riz about it. He's like, so if I can see you, you're in an arena, 25,000 people all coming here, you speak. That's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the book, which turned into an audiobook, was one of the steps in that. And I think that I now that I've written this memoir, I have more books in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty more that I want to write about. And there's plenty more that I want to talk about and maybe have a podcast.
Yeah.
I can see it.
You're a fucking wealth of knowledge and information.
Well, also your voice is
necessary.
Yeah, it's necessary, but yeah. you also have a confidence that's needed. Just the way you're speaking to us. Like just things you would say, I'd be like, oh, God, she's right.
Yeah.
Damn it, she's right.
Yeah.
But like that, you know, sometimes like I waver a lot where I feel myself being like, yeah, that was a good idea. And then I'm like, yeah. But like, I don't know. It's like, I guess, you know. I have a lot more learning to do. I'll just have to keep following your work.
Yeah,
I feel like I can learn a lot from you. And just being strong and having the confidence to believe that you're like, oh, wait, no, my story is worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also having the humility and being open enough. You know, I'm a Buddhist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not being attached to the outcome. Because, you guys, when I was writing my memoir, whether it sold 2 or 2 million, that's not what I'm attached to.
Yeah.
Of course, I would much rather, and I could be embarrassed and humiliated, but what I was attached to was writing the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Telling my story. What is important for me is that I do the best that I can. And then once you put it out in the world, that's beyond your control. All
right.
And it's a fool's errand to be so attached to that outcome, right?
Yeah.
It's a very central tenet of Buddhism, and that is non-attachment. So everything that I do, and I say the same thing to my kids, fuck perfection. I said this when they were really little, like, forget perfection. I don't want you to be perfect. I don't need straight A's. I don't give a shit about that. You know, mm-hmm. my daughter's writing the SATs. I'm like, honestly, babe, you're going to get in when you're fit in, and you're going to be amazing because you're brilliant. And I think that constant pushing of striving for something that is so difficult to reach, that can be traumatizing for people and for children. And I think that all I said to my kid was, do the best you can.
Yeah.
If you do the best you can and you fail geometry, who fucking cares? You failed, you know what I'm saying? Like, what, suddenly you're not a good person?
Yeah.
What's much more important to me is that my children are good, kind, just human beings. They are benevolent leaders. And that is a much greater legacy to me than anything else that I've accomplished.
You're a phenomenal parent.
I know.
I tried.
I wish you were my mom. Yeah.
Is it too late for that?
I want you to tell one last story, which you don't have to. You don't have to give every detail because you do. You talk about it in your book, so I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
I was trying to give some people something. You know, like you got to go. If you want to hear more, you got to go and get the book and listen to it because it's good and it will have you on the edge of your seat and you'll be like, your boyfriend will be like, come watch TV with me. And I'm like, shut up.
Based on a true story.
Based on a true story, I put it on the Bluetooth while taking a shower because I couldn't pause it.
Thank
you. But I was like, but I need to take a shower because I don't smell, but don't want to stop just yet. Got soap in my eye. You know, no big deal. I was enjoying it. But tell us kind of like how you came across Wu-Tang Clan.
So again, I was doing A&R Jive. I was a talent scout. And, you know, you get all these demos, you get all of these cassettes and these craft mailers and you kind of rip them open and you listen to them and mm-hmm. most of them are garbage. And then
pre-internet, man.
Exactly. Pre-internet, like ripping it open, getting all the fucking stuffing coming out of the craft bags. And by the time the Wu-Tang demo hit my desk, there was already a buzz around it.
Mm.
So there are three songs on it, Protect Your Neck, Tears, and Method Man. Shout out to Method Man, the platonic love of my life. Oh. So Protect Your Neck was already kind of gathering a buzz, and I listened to it. Now, RZA famously asked for, and historically this will go down in history, asked for what is called a non-exclusive deal. Now, if I sign Wu-Tang Clan as a label, it means that if you want to do a solo deal, if Method Man wants to do a solo deal, I have the option to sign him. Mm-hmm. But he got a non-exclusive deal, which that's why you have Method Man on Def Jam. You have GZA on Geffen. You have Ghostface on his label, Razor Sharp. And so I knew that I couldn't sign him, so I did not meet Wu-Tang based on that demo. But then RZA sends in a demo for another group that he was in called the Gravediggas, and that's when I met him. I met him first, and then I met the rest of the guys, and last was ODB.
Wow. And it's all history. And they became your friends.
And they, and I literally talked to RZA half an hour before I walked into this door.
I looked at, because I've creeped on you.
Oh, good.
I was looking at your Instagram, and, and you're like interviewing them. They're like, why should people get this book? And it's so funny that they're like, well, why not? Like,
right. Yeah. Right,
like,
yeah.
You have a great history, and
your
story is so important, and you are like, you are the baddest bitch in the room.
Thank you.
Everyone needs to hear your story.
And it's unique. There's nothing else like that. Like there's, your story is not repeatable.
Right.
You're the first of your kind. Only of your kind so far.
Thank
and I think Asian girls and children will I can already see it. Like I'm sure it's already happened.
Yeah.
You know, like your presence is so beyond just your existence. It's
You know, my brother said the most profound thing, and I actually wrote it in the epilogue, and he said, "You know, Sophia, when I was writing, he said, what you are doing with your memoir is you are simply asking the world to imagine that you exist."
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Again, I wrote this because I want you to like me. I don't give a fuck if you like me. But I want people, like you said, to be inspired by me. And it's not a try to be like Sophia Chang. The world, I couldn't stand another fucking Sophia Chang in the world. I don't want people to be like me. What I want is for people to be inspired by fearlessness.
Yeah.
You know, by caring less about what the dominant culture thinks. You know, for any of us that have felt undervalued, invisible, anybody that we were all told no, anybody that was told not to chase our dreams, as many of us as the children of immigrants, right? Mm-hmm. Any of us that have the audacity to tell our stories, that's who I wrote this for. Mm-hmm. And that's who I did this for. Like, get out there and just try to be a fuller version of yourself, because we are people of color in white supremacy. There are so many boxes placed on us, concentric boxes, right? And I feel like with my life, my very life, my quotidian life is an act of defiance. All those concentric boxes that have been placed upon me, I shred through them with the machete, you know, with a ninja blade. That's what I'm trying to do. And I hope that it's titillating enough and captivating and compelling enough that people think, you know, it inspires me to want to do more with my life and to be more fearless and try to be a more self-actualized version of myself.
That's awesome.
Fuck yeah.
Words to live by.
Yeah, seriously.
Where can people find your book, find you online, follow you?
Thank you for asking. My book is exclusively, my audiobook is exclusively on audible.com. It's audible.com/Soph Chang. Online, my Twitter handle is Soph Chang, S-O-P-H-C-H-A-N-G. And on Facebook and Instagram, my handle is Soph Chang NYC, S-O-P-H-C-H-A-N-G-N-Y-C. The platform where that I have found is the most organic to who I am is Instagram, for sure. It's where I, you know, it's where I'm the most expressive. It's where I have just premiered my new series, Suck a Dick, which I'm very excited about. I have many more episodes to come. My new hit series. But that's where you can find me. And I have a website, sophchang.com, S-O-P-H-C-H-A-N-G.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, ladies.
You are a truly phenomenal person here the whole time. And I'm so glad you're finally announcing your presence to the world.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everything that you can find on will be linked in the description, so you guys can one shop stop. Yeah. One stop shop.
Thank you. And I'm excited for you guys to keep doing what you do and telling your stories in the way that you tell your stories.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. We appreciate that.
I really do. You can follow us.
It's a great episode.
Yeah, it was amazing. You can follow us at EthnicallyAmb, A-M-B, on Twitter, and EthnicallyAmbig, A-M-B-I-G, on Instagram. We have a website, ethnicallyambiguouspod.com, and we have merch at tpublic.com/ethnicallyambiguous. You can follow me at Shirohero, S-H-E-E-R-O-H-E-R-O, on Instagram, and Shirohero666 on Twitter.
The devil lives. And I'm just at Anna Hosnia on Twitter. So
yeah.
Tweet me.
Seriously, don't listen to Sophia's book. It's, again, like not like your average audiobook. She really puts an effort to make it entertaining and thoughtful. And
it's a nice, easy listen. You can,
it's like
know.
A, it's like a play, not like a play. It's like a real life story, but it's
I wanted it to be like a movie that you listen to.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, no one's ever done this before. You have the author's voice, 25 guest voices, sound design, original score, and licensed music. Yeah. Literally no one's ever done that before.
That's exactly right. It's a movie that you can listen to.
Yeah.
It's an audio movie.
Yes.
And it's clean.
I have both.
Oh, you have both.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I have the clean version.
You listen to the clean version?
I don't think I have.
I was going to say.
Well, it's interesting because every time you swear, it's like, like it's like the.
Is it a kung fu sound effect?
No, no, it's the DJ record thing.
The record scratch.
Okay. It's funny. Oh, that's weird. I downloaded the clean version.
Somebody else said the same thing last night. The cursing version is much more fun.
Oh, okay. Well, you can get the clean if you want to listen in front of your kids, and then the dirty if you want to listen by yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Good both.
There you go.
But seriously, follow Sophia on everything, Soph Chang, and Soph Chang NYC on Twitter. And
stay the baddest bitch in the room.
Seriously, that is this worst to live by. You are so inspiring. Thank you so much. Until next time, we already said that. Stay the baddest bitch in the room. Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.